History is a palimpsest of voices speaking to us through time.
My feeling about history is that it is all voices from the grave, and we read history in a sense by reading letters, by reading documents, and even things like the layout of a town, the layout of a building, the construction of a building, in a sense, is writing. So everything is writing, and I was very aware that these people were, in a sense, writing and speaking their stories.
That's novelist Brian Keightley. We talked to him about The River Gods, his novel of Northampton, Massachusetts, from its founding to today. And the Connecticut River is the lifeblood of Northampton and the other towns that people the Pioneer Valley.
The Connecticut River is recognized by all types of residents as the region's most premier natural resource. It's, in a sense, the spinal column of the valley. It gives us strength, but it also gives us life. And we've realized, I think, collectively, that we almost threw this premier asset away. The valley is all about the Connecticut, and without it, we lose part of our identity.
That's Pioneer Valley Planning Commission Director Tim Brennan. He discusses the history and future of the Connecticut River in Massachusetts in the second half of the show. We'll also hear about the original inhabitants of the valley from Native American scholar Marge Brushack. That's all coming up on this edition of our Writer's Voice special series, The River Runs Through Us. I'm Francesca Rianna. In the local parlance of Western Massachusetts, the phrase the River Gods refers to the group of powerful men who held sway over the business and political life of the Connecticut River Valley in the 17th and 18th centuries. Northampton was one of those towns, and it's a setting for my guest Brian Keightley's novel, The River Gods. Written in a series of short vignettes, the novel shifts back and forth in time to reveal glimpses of the town's history, as well as the personal history of the author himself. The reader meets the fiery preacher Jonathan Edwards, Sojourner Truth, and other notable individuals from Northampton's history. We originally spoke to Brian Keightley several years ago about the book, but called him again for an interview redux for our River Runs Through Us series. The River Gods, first of all, tell us, what is the meaning of that term?
It was a term originally applied to ministers in the 1700s, even in the late 1600s in Northampton and around the area. But eventually it began to refer to both ministers and prominent businessmen who sometimes had two hats, business and preacher. But it was a general term for the sort of the powers of the Connecticut River Valley in Massachusetts.
You must have done an incredible amount of research for this book, The River Gods. It's a series of vignettes, really, that move back and forth in time, almost all of them taking place in and around Northampton, Massachusetts. You grew up in Northampton, is that right?
That's correct.
And you and your family are in some of the vignettes, although you say that those are some of the more fictionalized accounts. But what fascinates me for the purposes of this episode of our series, The River Runs Through Us, is the numbers of historical people that you talk about, some of whom are quite famous, some of whom I didn't even know, who spent some time in Northampton. I mean, Ludwig Wittgenstein, in fact, I never knew that that German philosopher had spent time in Northampton.
He did. He was a teacher of Alice Lazarowitz, who taught at Smith College for many years. She was his student in I believe, Cambridge. She's an American woman. She was American. But she studied with him and actually kept notes that became the Blue and the Brown Notebook, late published after Wittgenstein died.
And those were?
Those are the two of the crucial later texts of Wittgenstein's philosophical works. He published only one book in his lifetime, and then he began to profoundly disagree with it. It was, I think, the Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus. But it was an early version of his thinking, and he came to change his mind in many ways, profound ways. And Alice was an extraordinary extraordinary, important figure in her own right, but in this sense, too, she was really crucial. She was taking notes in a class, several classes that he taught.
That's an amazing story. But let's go back to the beginning, actually. May 1654, you have a vignette with a Gideon child at the age of 60, and he's a member of the original settlement of Naugatuck, and all these are in the first person. Tell us a little bit about him and his perspective.
He's a fictional figure. I use the name Child because it is an important name in Northampton history. Child's Park comes from that, and Lydia Child in the 19th century was a very important abolitionist and set up and helped to set up the Underground Railroad. But it's a mix of several. This is one of the things I did often in the book. It's a mix of several pieces of historical writing overview histories of North America, and I loved this line, the second line of that piece: "The Moors drove Spain and Portugal west to look for new trade routes to the Indies and China." Those first few sentences are from a historian from the 1950s. Not terribly well known now, but I just loved the language, and I rewrote it quite a bit. And I had this figure from the early days of Northampton, fictional figure, speaking as if in a sort of broad historical sense. And I do that a few times throughout the book.
So you're saying you got this sentence: "The Moors drove Spain and Portugal west to look for new trade routes to the India and China." And then he speaks about the establishment of Fort Good Hope, later called Hartford, and says you have him be along for the founding of Agawam, which was renamed Springfield by Pynchon. What are you establishing here with this vignette?
Well, a character who speaks beyond his own possibility of knowledge, in a sense. It's plausible, slightly plausible, that someone might have a broad historical view of the world at that time. And these were very educated and very smart people who established some of these towns. But I'm really concerned at that point, and it's close to the beginning of the novel, so it was an issue for me to create a set of rules or even kind of a guide to the book. And it also has a direct quote from the contract that Pynchon wrote up and had the Indians sign when they signed over Naugatuck, which became Northampton. So that the end of the piece is direct historical record.
Here you talk about the Indians. Tell us, how did Naugatuck become Northampton? What was the sale?
It wasn't a lot of money per se. It was a small, I think it was a kind of typical of the time, beads. The Europeans knew that the Indians were very attracted to and were, in a sense, their form of currency. They didn't have very much value at all to the English.
Naugatuck was an important settlement, I believe. I think it means bend in the river. Describe a little bit of the river here in Northampton.
Well, it goes sideways, and there used to be a lake thousands of years ago, Lake Hitchcock, named after the geologist who realized that this probably was the case. So the Mount Tom and Mount Holyoke, they used to be connected, and the lake was backed up behind it for hundreds of miles up to northern Vermont. And when it broke through, there was this interesting turn in the river and a huge loop, which later became broken off. Maybe, I'm not sure if humans did this or if the river itself just pushed straight through, but what is now called the Oxbow was painted, famously, a beautiful painting by Thomas Cole, the painter.
Yes, and we have that on our website for listeners who'd like to see that.
And it's that image is a fascinating image from the 19th century, and it's what Northampton was well known for, and also the fact that there was once this great riverbed made the land incredibly fertile. It still is very, very fertile land. So it's one of the reasons Northampton was a very successful settlement very early on.
And although the Indians sold this area of Naugatuck, which became Northampton, to Thomas Pynchon, later on, you have an entry in the novel The River Gods, August 1675, John Pynchon, age 49, during King Philip's War. What is this about? What was King Philip's War?
It was a war that happened a few decades before the American Revolution, and it was a battle between the French and the British, and they had proxies both. I think the French had more Native American proxies on their side. King Philip was an Indian leader, and this was one of the battles over who could gain a real foothold in North America and manage it as a colony. The British sort of mostly won, but it was a fairly brutal set of battles between colonies in the U.S. and British soldiers, as well as the French and I think their much larger contingent of Native American soldiers.
And yeah, and I think I said Thomas Pynchon before.
Thomas. Yeah, the novelist is related to,
is
to John
really?
Pynchon.
I didn't know that. John Pynchon. Yes, King Philip was a Native American.
He was. I mean, it's an odd name for a Native American, but he was a Native American. Yes.
Now, one figure that appears, that recurs a number of times throughout your book, throughout the novel, The River Gods, although I hesitate to call it a novel because in some ways it's a composite of fiction and nonfiction, is Jonathan Edwards, a very, very famous figure in the history of Northampton. We already talked about him on this in this series, but I want to ask you, first of all, say who he was, and then what was the fascination of Edwards for you, that you would come at him with a whole number of different angles?
He was a minister for 20 or 30 years in the early 1700s, the third or fourth minister. His grandfather, Solomon Stoddard, was for much of the late 17th century, the minister in Northampton, a great figure. And Edwards came, I think, in the early 1700s and was very, very persuasive and also a well-known writer. By the time he was fired from his pulpit for a number of reasons. And that firing was actually one of the early democratic efforts of American colonies. It led to some of the thinking about how to wrest the whole continent or the whole set of colonies from the British control. But my own personal relationship to him is when we moved to Northampton in 1962, my parents joined Edwards Church, named after Jonathan, and we it was something that was in my mind. My father, who is a philosopher, was asked a few times to speak to various groups in the church about Edwards as a philosopher, and he hadn't thought much about him before coming to Northampton, but when he did a little bit of reading, he was startled to realize that he was not only a very good writer, but a very, very smart philosopher, and he was well known throughout Europe and England, maybe the first really great American writer that was known in Europe. And I gained some appreciation of that from my father, and I also just had a fascination with his writing myself. I've always liked it. He freaks me out in some ways. He used to more than he does now, but he is a very hypnotic prose writer, I think.
He freaked you out?
Well, The Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, famous sermon about hell. His approach to, I mean, it's very unfamiliar to me as a 20th century congregational Christian that I was as a child. I left the church as soon as I could as an adult, but I was a member of the church, and my family was very close to the minister, Richard Beebe, who was a lovely man all through my childhood. So we knew that church, and that was a very different church than Jonathan Edwards' version of that church in the 1700s.
We're talking with Brian Keightley about his novel, which has much history in it. It's called The River Gods, and it is a series of vignettes, historical vignettes, throughout the history of the Northampton region in western Massachusetts. Now, you have, I'd actually like to get into this issue of the firing of Jonathan Edwards. You know, I knew that it had happened. I knew that the people in the town felt that he had undue influence over who would be members of his church and who not, but I had never seen it framed in the terms of democracy. And you have this character who's an historical figure, Seth Pomeroy, at the age of 44 in June of 1750, who is talking about Jonathan Edwards. Could you find that place and maybe read? I wanted to start with, he locks himself away and reads.
Yes, okay. I can read that.
Mm-hmm.
Seth Pomeroy, age 44. He locks himself away and reads. He reads too much. His sermons printed on fine paper are well and good, if one has the patience for such stuff. He is an intoxicated visionary who presumes to see the will of God. We might be better served by a more vigorous and open-air man, a friend of the farms and the river and the cattle. How will Parson Edwards know the truth of a man's heart and sinfulness if he knows only what he reads? A man's vigor might be mistaken for sin. One of our elders said, the more learned and witty you are, the more likely Satan will employ you. I make guns. I am a soldier. I know what I know because I feel it in my hands.
And so what are you saying here? What is this contrast between Seth Pomeroy and Jonathan Edwards in the context of Edwards' firing and the whole emerging idea of democracy?
Well, the more important figure in that section, in a way, is Joseph Hawley, who was Edwards' nephew. And Hawley and Pomeroy, or friends, Pomeroy was older, but a major figure during the Revolutionary War. And I believe he had some great disdain for what Edwards was doing late in his time as minister, but it was really Joseph Hawley, who was a lawyer, who, much to his heartbreak, really agitated to bring this to a vote and to get Edwards fired. He regretted it later in his life. He wrote a lovely letter about that. I can't remember to whom or where, but he was the main factor in this, and he was also a major figure during the Revolution. He worked with John Adams and a number of others to create the Constitution, although he was suffering from melancholy that was so severe he stayed back in Northampton during the actual writing of the Constitution. But he was a crucial figure leading up to it, and he and John Adams wrote to each other a great deal about what was happening and what Adams was trying to achieve.
Well, there's a lot of controversy among the founding fathers, I think, around the rights of the people, around democracy. I mean, they were not as much Democrats as I think many Americans have been led to believe. What was Joseph Hawley's position?
I think he was Republican, in a sense. I mean, in the old sense of that word. What I recall, and I may be wrong, but what I recall is that he and Adams were very upset by some of the compromises that the Southern colonies, the Southern states, were pushing for instance, the Senate, which was a compromise to keep the Southern states in line because they were much smaller, had many fewer white voters, and they might have been, if there'd simply been a parliament or a House of Representatives and no Senate, they might have been overruled over time and again, and slavery might have been abolished immediately or very soon after the Independence and after the Revolution.
Wow. Slavery, or the fight against slavery, comes up again. Northampton was actually a place on the Underground Railroad. Is that right?
That's correct.
Could you say a little bit more about that? I mean, we talk about, I'd like to get to Sojourner Truth. You have one vignette with her from 1852. But before talking about her, she gives mention of the Bridge Street home of Seth Hunt, a treasurer of the Connecticut River Railroad and a free thinker. She says, it is said his home is a stop on the Underground Railroad, which I will neither confirm nor deny.
That's that's what I know, too. I mean, I built that section on Sojourner Truth out of biography of her. And I took, you know, in a lot of cases in this book, I took other people's writing and initially had just sort of a lot of direct quotations. About a third of the book in an early version of it was long, either quotations or paraphrases. And gradually I began to eliminate most of those. These were historical figures, quotations from letters, quotations from historians as well. And I got dissatisfied with that approach and removed most of them. And then some of them I began to fiddle with and turn into my own prose in a sense. I kept a lot of the sense of that biographical entry about Sojourner Truth, and I was combining several paragraphs together. But it was definitely a practice that I tried to operate under in many different cases, in many different situations in the book.
To kind of paraphrase, to take from the historical writings.
Yeah, to use a direct, in a sense, it's a kind of direct quote that I have improved, I guess. I've taken and made, first, for one thing, because this was a biography of Sojourner Truth, it was a third-person story, in a sense. Mm-hmm. And I just changed it into her voice, using some of the language of this biography. And I believe at the end of the book, I may mention which biography it is. It was something I did in part out of frustration. I was having trouble figuring out the order of the book and figuring out some of the basic rules of it, even as late as a year and a half or two before I finished the book. And it took about 9 years to write it. It's not a huge book, but it took a long time. But that was a kind of compromise I stumbled on, and I enjoy. I mean, that's something like what I described at the beginning of the interview with the Gideon Child piece as well.
Talk a little bit about, as a fiction writer, using history and the history of this region, about that process of working with that material psychologically for you. I mean, you grew up here, your family is in this book, and yet so much is in the first person of so many historical figures. Say a little bit about how did you, over the 9 year process, how did struggling with this book inform your own literary voice?
Well, each of my books, it seems, and it's a maddening thing for me, but each one I try to find the reason I'm making it, first of all, and then each one seems to impose its own set of rules on the style. My first novel was about my grandfather, a chemist and an entomologist. So there was a very important way of seeing the world. And this book had some of those same problems and rules. I knew I was writing a history, and I called it A History of Northampton for a long time. I mean, I also called it The River Gods, but I liked thinking of it as a history. So I was trying to find ways to make it work, and I've always believed that style is the result of a combination of point of view and subject matter. And you can't impose a style, I don't think, on a story. You have to let the style come out slowly and naturally. The first-person voices of all these characters, for instance, was a very late addition. About half of them, or maybe two-thirds, were first-person, and I decided to make them all first-person at a certain point. And that was also kind of a revelation and useful to me.
And why?
I liked hearing all these voices, ghostly voices, nearly all of them speaking to us, except for my own family. Most of my family are dead, and so I thought of them as ghosts and as people speaking from the grave or from the past. My feeling about history is that it is all voices from the grave, and we read history, in a sense, by reading letters, by reading documents, and even things like the layout of a town, the layout of a building, the construction of a building, in a sense, is writing. So everything is writing, and I was very aware that these people were, in a sense, writing and speaking their stories. So when I realized that, I decided it just had to all be a consistent kind of voice. And there's some complaining I've read in reviews that there's too many, it's too similar, that each voice is a lot like my voice, but I don't mind.
Well, I think that actually, I mean, I felt there were some differences, but there's also great intimacy in this novel, The River Gods. You know, Brian Keightley, not just by bringing in your family, but also with the first person, this sense of the intimate connection with the layers of history, it's very seductive. It drew me in tremendously. You don't live in Northampton now, but when you were writing this book, did you feel that you were moving through the layers of your own time connected to your place where you grew up?
Yes, and I was resuscitating the experience. I definitely was. I was fascinated by the town, seeing it the way I was seeing it, and it seemed important to me to try and understand where I was from, what I was from.
And in one of the last segments in the book, you say, I actually love this. It's a little too long for us to read here, but you go through the street names, First Square, Fourth, Fifth, Paradise, Florence, Bliss, Young Rainbow, Old Rainbow, Fairfield, Fern, Locust, Myrtle, Maple, Elm, Audubon. Those are just a few. It's a kind of poetry, really, in the street names.
I agree. I mean, I can't remember where I got the idea just to list those street names. I think I must have stumbled upon some website that had a lot of the names, and I think I selected a couple of dozen of them, and then I began to organize them as if they were a story, not the way they are situated in Northampton itself. And it was fun. It was an interesting way of reading the town in my mind.
You know, I think probably there are many special and wonderful places in the U.S. and in any region of the country, but this one does seem to be special. What is Northampton to you? What is the Connecticut River to you?
Well, the river is it's a really just a kind of gorgeous and calm thing. I mean, I know there have been floods over the last few decades, but it always struck me as being a very gentle presence in our lives. We drove up to Montreal to see my father's parents all the time, so we traveled along it for 100 miles or so many, many times. And the town itself is fascinating to me because it does have so much. It was really so important for a long time. In the 20th century, less so, although one of our presidents was its mayor, so it had its own interesting cachet.
Calvin Coolidge.
But once when I lived in New York City in the early 80s, I was listening to an interview with Miles Davis, and the interviewer said, "Are you doing much touring?" And Davis said, no, just mostly going back and forth between Boston and Northampton and New York. And I assumed the New York audience had no idea what Northampton he was talking about. Perhaps thought he might be mentioning one of the Hamptons, but there is no Northampton on Long Island. In any case, it was a strange thing to hear that Northampton was still included in that litany of small group of big cities in the Northeast. And he was referring to the Iron Horse, the great jazz bar in downtown Northampton, and not necessarily Northampton itself, although Northampton had a great jazz scene and great jazz musicians working at UMass for many years.
That's right. There was Archie Shepp.
Archie Shepp.
Well, Brian Keightley, it's just, I was so happy to have the opportunity to reread your novel, The River Gods, and I want to thank you so much for talking with us again on Writer's Voice about it.
My pleasure.
Brian Keightley teaches creative writing at the University of Denver. In addition to The River Gods, he's the author of two other novels, Still Life with Insects and I Know Many Songs, But I Cannot Sing, as well as two books of writing exercises. Next up, we visit native Northampton. just around the time the English settlers came.
Slowly, slowly, they return to the small woodland, let alone great trees outspreading and upright apostles of the living light. Patient as stars, they build in air, tier after tier, a timbered choir, stout beams upholding.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. A few years ago, in the dead of winter, Abenaki storyteller and scholar Marge Bruchak took me on a fascinating tour of what might be termed Native Northampton, the places and traces where the Native Algonquian tribes of the region made their home at the Great Bend of the Connecticut River, where later the English colonists founded Northampton. The Indians called it variously Nonotuc or Norwatic. They first went to Fort Hill, a place Brian Keightley lived as a child and the figures in his novel, The River Gods. There, Marge Bruchak revealed the outline of the Native settlement under the modern town, a place that's been settled for 12,000 years.
We're on the lower side of the terrace that Fort Hill is situated on. So that to the west of us is the Mill River that Native people called the Kapawanganik. The English settlement was allowed to settle on the western side of the Mill River, which is also on the western side of the Quinnecticut or the Connecticut River, to facilitate trade. But Native people continued to use the cornfields to the south of us in the meadows and fields that are now below what we call Hospital Hill. So the interesting thing about the placement of a Native fort in this general area is that you have very easy access to the river, very easy access to your corn planting fields, and you just hop across the water to the trading post. You also get to keep a very close eye on the English settlement there. The reason it has the name Fort Hill, there are locations all through this valley that go by the name of Indian Hill, Indian Fort, etc. And what most of those represent are places where there were Native communities who, after European contact, built some kind of fortified settlement, in part to be close to a trading post, in part because of the intertribal wars that were going on. This Fort Hill was constructed specifically by the Nonotuc in order to facilitate trade with John Pynchon at Northampton. The Nonotuc Fort was built in 1664, about 30 years after William Pynchon had established a trading post at Springfield, and then William's son, John Pynchon, was engaged in trade at Northampton with Native people from farther north. And the Nonotuc specifically built that fortified settlement to be closer for the fur trade. But Pynchon compelled them to adhere to specific conditions while they lived in the fort, and these included, quote, "They shall not break the Sabbath by working or gaming or carrying burdens. They shall not powwow on that place or anywhere else amongst us. They shall not take in Indians of other places to seat amongst them. We allow only Nawadog Indians that were the inhabitants of that place."
Marge Bruchak explained that the word Norwatic or Nonotuc, both names of this place, referred to a phrase meaning in the midst of the river.
And it doesn't refer to islands in the midst of the river, but it refers to the settlements on either side of the place where the river does its oxbow. And that oxbow has shifted over time. And one reason for the thick settlement here is that the alluvial lands it built up were so rich for farming. So it was especially concentrated settlement when there were cornfields here. And the confusion among Indian names is really interesting because in this valley, virtually all of the names that we use as tribal names are actually locative terms. They're place names. So one possibility that the records seem to bear out is that the Nonotuc, Pocumtuck, Agawam, Warnoco, etc., were all very closely related. And they may not have actually viewed themselves as separate tribes, but as separate, distinct tribal communities that were all engaged in similar activities and similar relations. And we know there was a great deal of intermarriage between them. And after colonial settlement is when they really worked together. And what we see consistently is that these tribes always hung together in resisting English settlement.
Next, we headed for Hospital Hill, where the state mental hospital used to be, and some of its imposing structures still stand. We did the tour in the middle of the winter. You can hear our boots crunching on the icy snow underfoot.
You look around, here's the river behind us. We're standing in the middle of Naugatuck cornfields. We're looking at this nice, glacial came that's perfect for a settlement. There are springs behind there, so you've got good sources of fresh water. We've also got the evidence of cornfields that persisted right into the 1920s and 30s down here. But now it's just a playground. We're walking on what's called Pancake Plain. Flat.
Right. And this is where the Indian cornfields were.
Mm-hmm. One reason to get to this part of the hill is that you can get some sense of the lay of the land. We're standing on what's now called Hospital Hill. We're looking down at a large flat area, but looking across, we can see parts of the Holyoke Range. If we were to gaze towards the north, we would see other hills in the distance. This valley was created by a great glacier that came through here. When the glacier melted, it filled the valley with water. When it receded, it left behind much of the resistant rock and a lot of glacial formations. And then as the rivers come through the valley, so all of the rivers, the Connecticut River, what's now called the Deerfield River, the Mill River, all of these rivers meander through this valley, depositing silt over hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years until you have very rich bottomlands, very well-drained terraces, and just perfect areas for settlements and habitation. So when Native people lived here, what you would find is clusters of communities on the bottomlands, sometimes hills on the terraces, and trails connecting all of them. By about 2,000 years ago, there was a lot of intensive maize agriculture here. When Europeans first looked at this valley, it seemed ideal for European settlement for that same reason. But it also had, by and large, already been cleared, because Native people would burn over the forest periodically to both clear some areas for travel, to encourage browse, to encourage deer and other populations, and then also cleared areas for corn planting.
The traces of Native American life are to be found in the Yankee culture that succeeded it.
Much of what we think of today as Yankee lifeways is actually Native lifeways, Algonquian Indian in particular. The simplest one is corn. Corn is an indigenous plant from this part of the world. Maple sugar, the styles of farming, the kind of use of lands, the travel, the trails, even roads like 91 are built on what were once Indian trails, travel on the riverways facilitated by canoe, travel during winter facilitated by toboggans and snowshoes. So a lot of Native technology was adopted straight into Yankee culture. And just the way of situating, even the simplest thing of situating home sites where there were already existing Native home sites. So in many ways, when you think about it, the layout of what we think of as New England was heavily influenced by the ways in which Native people used the land. But again, that's why we have that sense that it's so hard to see Native presence, because I often tell people if you want to find the densest evidence of Native habitation, you're going to have to dig under the oldest English towns.
Marge Bruchak, a storyteller and scholar, she's co-author of the book 1621, A New Look at Thanksgiving. Next, a look at the present and future of the river for the Massachusetts towns living along it. Throughout this series, we've talked to writers, historians, and sociologists about the connection that people have had with the Connecticut River in the past. We've heard how the river was influential in spreading ideas of freedom and spirituality, as well as serving as the birthplace of the American Industrial Revolution and a model for middle-class communities. But those communities' connection to the Connecticut River doesn't just exist in the past. The river continues to be a living, vital resource in their present lives as well. In fact, for them, the river may be the most important economic resource of the next 50 years. If the Connecticut River Valley is to have a viable economic future, it needs to base it on green energy and technology. For that, it needs the power that only the river can provide. But there are daunting challenges in making that future happen. Environmental degradation, poorly planned housing and manufacturing development, and the loss of federal government investment in the river make it difficult to fully realize its economic potential. But there are bright spots. The city of Holyoke is now using the river to generate clean hydropower for the Massachusetts Green High Performance Computing Center. It's a $180 million investment by a consortium of universities to create a high-tech center in the city's ailing post-industrial economy. And several river communities, including Springfield, Northampton, Agawam, Hadley, Amherst, and Chicopee, have banded together to create an interconnected Connecticut River bikeway and rail trail to increase recreational activity on the river. Yet much work remains to be done if the Connecticut River is going to realize its potential in a sustainable way that connects communities to each other and to the river itself. Timothy Brennan, Executive Director of the Pioneer Valley Planning Commission, is helping to lead and shape much of that work. The commission is an organization of 43 cities along the Connecticut River charged with coordinating and encouraging cooperation between business, government, and citizens on issues related to the Pioneer Valley. For the last 25 years, Brennan and the PVPC have worked to clean up the river in order to maximize its economic potential. Writer's Voice associate producer Drew Adamack talked with Brennan about the river's potential, the challenges its communities face, and how something as simple as a bike path can create community, economic development, and environmental sustainability.
Tim, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Before we talk about the river, tell me a little bit about the Pioneer Valley Planning Commission and your role in it.
Pioneer Valley Planning Commission is a public agency. We've been around for a half century. There's hundreds of my type of organization across the country. And essentially, we were put together in the post-World War II period to solve problems that go beyond individual municipal boundaries and also to chase opportunities. And so Connecticut River cleanup is a perfect example of a problem that doesn't respect political boundaries, and yet it's our premier resource. So cleanup is all important, and we have certain kinds of federal mandates to do that.
We've talked over the course of this series with historians and writers and a sociologist in our last episode about the importance of the Connecticut River in the past as an economic engine. But how do you see, or how does your organization see the river now as an economic engine?
It's an economic engine in a variety of ways. First of all, it is our premier natural resource. And as such, particularly in the cleanest sections of the river, which are upstream, it's a tremendous magnet for all kinds of water activities, boating, some extent swimming in the best of conditions, water skiing, and on it goes. So there's various kinds of marinas and other kinds of tourist or hospitality industries that depend upon it. It also is a draw just in terms of tourism, particularly during the fall season where the foliage is so wonderful. And then last but not least, water tends to attract development. And this is, again, where we have to strike a balance between trying to keep the Connecticut River watershed protected, but at the same time, there are parts of it, particularly in the urban core, where development essentially abuts onto the river itself. So those are the principal ways that it's been an economic engine of late. I think it should be noted from a historical perspective, the Connecticut River was really our first means of transportation here in the valley.
Historically, the Connecticut River was not only a form of transportation, but it was also a form of power. particularly in some of the mill towns. How does the Connecticut River fit into this idea of a sort of a green economy in the future?
Well, the premier example of that in a contemporary fashion is in the city of Holyoke, our first planned industrial city in the United States. The city of Holyoke several years ago took custody of the Holyoke Dam, and by doing so, accessed water power, which at one point in our history made Holyoke one of the most premier economic centers in the world, never mind the United States. By having that green power and at a very low cost and essentially much lower than the rest of New England, Holyoke was able to attract the construction of the green Massachusetts Green High Performance Computing Center, which is a consortium built of higher education institutions, MIT, Harvard, University of Massachusetts, Northeastern, and Boston University. It's a 160, 70 million facility between the building and all the computer power inside of it. It would not have come to Holyoke but for the fact that Holyoke had green power and very inexpensive power. So I think it's a signature of in a contemporary way, how the river has been important in the past, but once again in the future, vis-a-vis power generation.
How does the Holyoke or the Massachusetts Green High Performance Computing Center stand as a model for the economic future based around the river?
The way I would put it is that it's a model of back to the future. As I was pointing out earlier on, Holyoke, at a point in time in history, was viewed as one of the most premier economic centers in the world based on the power from the river that was harnessed to make a huge manufacturing mecca in the city. That, of course, has gone away over time, but this is a chance for Holyoke to reinvent itself using the asset of the low-cost green power, but also harnessing today's new technology. And certainly that's a premier example when you get to computers and IT. So the expectation is that now that the High Performance Computing Center is built, beginning to operate, it will attract small and mid-sized firms that are also attracted to that asset, and therefore give a new economic base to the city and the broader region.
I want to go back to something that you talked about earlier, and that is the cleanliness of the river and the relationship between places where it's clean and places where it's not, and the ability to use the river. Will you talk about some of the economic challenges that the river has in relationship to its environmental standards?
Yes. Unhappily, the legacy of the Connecticut was for many, many decades to treat it as essentially a cesspool, a place to deposit waste materials. In fact, it gained in the 60s and 70s the moniker of being the best landscape sewer in the United States. Then came the Clean Water Act in the early 1970s and a mandate to get rivers of various types all across the country up to what the federal government refers to as Class B water. That's fishable, swimmable water. That's the goal for the entire segment. This is the exact problem that we've been working on for 25 years now, and we have reduced pollution by probably on the order of 50%+. However, the cleanliness is mainly north of the Holyoke Dam. That's where we've achieved Class B water most of the year. Below the Holyoke Dam, however, is the traditional urban core of Holyoke, Chicopee, and Springfield. There we have lots of what are called combined sewer overflows. And when the sewage treatment plants get overwhelmed, they essentially spill raw sewage out into the river. You're never going to achieve Class B water until that problem is solved. But that's a very, very expensive problem, probably on the order of $300 million. And these are cities that are not wealthy. They are stressed in all kinds of ways. And so the tension is between wanting to clean up the river to get to Class B, how expensive it is, and the fact that resources from the federal government are very, very modest to do that job.
The river needs a significant investment in order to clean it up and bring it up to standards in order to help drive the economic activity around the river. Where is that investment coming from, and how do you see that investment playing out over the next 10, 20, 50 years?
The way it played out in the past until very recently was that we were able to work with the congressional delegation, former Congressman Olver and current Congressman Neal, to get an annual earmark. The Senate delegation helped out as well. And by doing so, we were able to get a very modest amount of money, typically $1.5, $2 million a year. And then the cities, particularly, again, the urban core cities, the Springfields, Holyoke, and Chicopees, commingled their funds with it. And slowly but steadily, we've made this progress over the last 25 years. Earmarks, however, have been eliminated in Washington. That is our new dilemma. Now what do we do? We have the resources of the cities, but these are very, very strained cities in terms of their economic largesse. So we're searching for ways to come up with a new solution, but this is not a problem that can be fixed with monopoly money. It's a very expensive problem, and if we're going to get to Class B water, there has to be public resources to do that. There's no earmarks, but we're trying to chase federal and state dollars to continue to make that progress and not lose the progress we've achieved over these decades. That's where the rub is. And now we face this new, somewhat unanticipated problem of our steady but slow progress being interrupted by an exit of the federal government from even the very modest amount of money that we were getting on an annual basis to move towards this Class B water goal. So that's, I think, our crucible right now. How do we hold on to the progress we made? How do we move forward when resources, particularly out of the federal and state governments, are so lean?
You are listening to The River Runs Through Us on Writer's Voice. Today I am talking to Tim Brennan, Executive Director of the Pioneer Valley Planning Commission. You mentioned a couple of things, and when people think of, when I think of economic activity, I think of manufacturing and producing something, but that also means recreation on the river.
Right.
What are the different types of economic activity based around the river? How does that drive economic activity?
Well, again, over the last 20, 30 years, there's been a rediscovery that we should access the river. Unfortunately, what we've done, particularly in the Pioneer Valley, is had the unfortunate circumstance of fencing people off from the river by building interstate highways and other kinds of infrastructure barriers to get to the river. So there's been an earnest effort to try to cobble together a linear sort of path of bikeways and pedestrian trails to acquire pieces of land in some sort of corridor fashion along the Connecticut River to take advantage of it and get a connection between people and the river, as was once true. So that's been an area we have projects that are done, such as the Springfield Riverwalk, ones that are in design right now in Chicopee, Agawam, West Springfield. So the grand scheme here is to try to ring the entire Connecticut River with a pattern of linear north-south bike and pedestrian ways.
So much of this series has been about people's connection to the river. We've talked about people's spiritual connection to the river, and now we're talking about the economic connection to the river. And I want to belabor that point a little bit because I think it's really important. You're not really talking about, in most instances, building new factories, but just allowing people to have access to the river and to interact with it. And how does that simple interaction drive economic activity? How is that valuable?
Well, again, if you get Class B water, then you can think about putting your a boat in the water or your body into the water. You would have trepidations about that if the various kinds of pollutants are in the water for your own personal health. Then there's things like fish consumption. How safe is it to fish and then could consume the fish that you might catch? So another aspect which is we've taken a lot of interest in and seems to be having big payoffs is to now work with others to recruit volunteers to actually do water sampling for us, to actually have volunteers rather than paid staff collecting samples, which then collected and taken to labs, to actually show and demonstrate quantitatively what kinds of problems we have and what progress we're making or what progress we're losing. And I think by doing that, we're building an army of men and women and kids, for that matter, that know about the river, have made a different kind of connection to it, and then have a commitment that's very, very intense in terms of getting to cleanup. And we're going to need that kind of support, obviously, if we're ever going to build enough public momentum to get the very, very high levels of dollars you need to fix this problem.
And what's the relationship between the river and agriculture, which is a large economic driver in this region?
That's a very good question. And again, there's a change going on here. One of the things about the Pioneer Valley and the Connecticut River Valley is it has the prime agricultural soils. Once again, like manufacturing, much agriculture has gone away. It's not been economically viable. We've seen a renaissance, though, of agriculture. Smaller farms, but also interest in things like organic food. So folks like myself now buy shares through the summer and are buying organic food that otherwise we would be buying in the grocery store. Even in the grocery store, we're seeing a trend where farms here in the valley are supplying food to large-scale supermarket vendors. So there's been an explosion of interest in food, in what we call food security, growing more of our own, and the valley is literally proliferated now with farmers' markets. So I think there's something very, very positive going on here that reinvigorates agriculture. Again, there is an issue, though. We have to balance that against the various kinds of organic or non-organic materials that are used on the fields that can create a problem, particularly if water carries those chemicals back off and then dumps it back in the river.
A lot of what you're talking about in relation to the river and economic activity, both in agriculture and in recreation, is really about drawing together community. Am I hearing that correctly, or what's the relationship between creating sort of a more intertwined community around the river?
I think, as I said earlier on, the Connecticut River is recognized by all types of residents as the region's most premier natural resource. It's, in a sense, the spinal column of the valley. It gives us strength, but it also gives us life. And we've realized, I think, collectively, that we almost threw this premier asset away, damaged it severely, and we're trying to bring it back. That is a long, arduous, expensive process, but I do think there's widespread support that the Connecticut is all about the valley. The valley is all about the Connecticut, and without it, we lose part of our identity.
Thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure.
That was Pioneer Valley Planning Commission Director Tim Brennan talking with Writers Voices' Drew Adamek. And that's it for this episode in our special series, The River Runs Through Us. The series is funded by a grant from Mass Humanities and by contributors to our Kickstarter campaign. Go to the series webpage at writersvoice.net for a list of donors. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight into your inbox or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. Drew Adamek is Writer's Voice Associate Producer. Our webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.